For LA Times Studios and The Real, I'm Mark Olson. The Cannes Film Festival in France just recently wrapped up, and so we're here to sort of go over this year's goings-on, and to do that, we have two members of the team of reporters that we had there in France. I'm joined today by
Justin Chang, film critic for the LA Times.
Amy Kaufman. Bonjour, Mark.
Now, Justin, I think you've been to the festival many times, and there's often, and I think this year in particular, here in America, a lot of the sort of press response to the coverage of the festival is in some part motivated by the question of why does this matter? These are movies that oftentimes will get a minimal release here in the States. The winner of the festival last year, The Square, made under $2 million at the U.S. box office, although it was nominated for an Academy Award. And so to you, what is the importance of Cannes? Why, or do you, feel that it still matters?
I do think it still matters. I admittedly probably in the minority in thinking that, and because it's my job to love movies from all corners of the globe, Cannes is still just the best place to experience that. It gives you this annual snapshot of the year's best in international cinema. That doesn't mean that, you know, the movies in Cannes are always the best or that there aren't great movies premiering at other festivals from Sundance to Toronto to Berlin to Venice to whatever. But one of the reasons I was sort of irritated, especially this year, by sort of advance obituaries for the Cannes Film Festival, because it looked like an off year, because mainly there were no American, there were American films, but there were not that many American films compared to previous years. There were not a lot of films that looked like Oscar contenders. The whole spat with Netflix, you know, which cost Cannes a couple juicy
what
titles.
What was the spat with Netflix?
Well, it's so, recap as quickly as possible as I can. Last year, there were two films, Okja and The Meyerowitz Stories, that were Netflix titles that Cannes allowed in competition. And that really angered the French exhibitors because they have very strict rules in France that, you know, there's like a 36-month streaming window, and which is ridiculous, by the way. And we'll clearly have to change at some point, I isn't that. But because, and Cannes is kind of caught in the middle here because they want to show these movies, some of which are by, you know, great filmmakers like Bong Joon-ho and Noah Baumbach. But they felt their hands were tied and they had to sort of say, okay, last year was the one year we allowed Netflix in, but from going forward, if a Netflix film wants to be in competition, they're not banning it from the whole festival. You know, they were perfectly happy to give Netflix places out of competition, but they would have to give the films a French theatrical release. So there was a lot of not the greatest behavior on both sides of this debate, which it shows that Cannes is at the very center of this debate because it represents a very traditional idea of cinema and of the theatrical experience and French cultural exceptionalism, which festivals like Venice, I believe, you know, don't mind showing, you know, Netflix films in competition. It's just not an issue for them. They also don't have those stringent window rules. So for all these reasons, though, I can't remember the last Cannes, and Amy, I know this was your first time going, so, you know, it's funny because I'm curious to know what you think of just the sort of criticism it was getting, but I can't remember the last time there was just so much just dread and criticism and frustration and bad feeling hanging over the festival, which turned out to be really good, I think, and a better one than last year, despite and maybe even because of the lack of big names, because there were some really good movies, and maybe these were, you know, filmmakers you've never heard of from countries you don't know much about, but it's like, that's what's exciting to me, so yeah.
Right, but that's not what's exciting to most people who cover it, I think. And it was so odd being my first time there because there was so much negativity from veteran journalists like, ugh, I'm so sorry this is your first Cannes. Like, this is the one you came on. This really sucks for you. And I was like, first of all, guys, we are by the Mediterranean, like being paid to eat burrata for lunch. So let's like get a reality check. And second of all, since when is it just because there aren't so many celebrities here that like the whole festival is dying? We can interview people at the Bel Air Hotel who are famous. Like, why is that what we have to be doing here?
Amy, tell me a little bit about this as your first experience. It was something you wrote about. The first kind of piece you wrote going into the festival was about your first experience walking the red carpet on opening night. And maybe one way to put that as a question is, what were you expecting? What did you think you were kind of walking into by going for the first time to the Cannes Film Festival?
I mean, I was totally overwhelmed. Like, Justin came by my desk and tried to explain, there's all these new rules this year. The press screenings aren't at the same time as the premiere screenings. And here's traditionally what we do, but we're not going to do that this year. And then everyone's saying, oh, there's no celebrities. Like, I don't even know what you're going to cover. And then as far as the red carpet goes, like, in my mind, the red carpet at Cannes is pretty much the biggest red carpet there is. You know, you see those pictures of the huge staircase going up. And there's these rules, like, you can't, women have to wear high heels. And obviously, you have to wear a black tie. And they also banned selfies or photographs of any kind from amateur photographers on the red carpet. So there's supposedly this, like, different vibe. So going into it, I was like, what's this going to be like? And the first night, Justin very graciously agreed to put on his tux and have the experience with me of this film. Everybody knows Asghar Farhadi. How do you say his name?
Asghar Farhadi, yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you. Mm-hmm. And which Javier Bardem and Penelope Cruz were in. So they're big stars, by the way. And at the carpet, it really does feel like, for people back here, it just feels so fancy. Like, I've been on a lot of red carpets in Hollywood and at the Oscars and the most fancy carpets we have here. And they play music there. They play the Carnival of the Animals, which is that, like, famous
yeah.
French composition, as people, and they have the whole cast line up in a line. So, like, everybody knows the director and Javier and Penelope are all holding hands and walk up straight directly as this classical music is playing, and they're emceeing it in French, and they're like, Javier Bardem, and they, like, say, they're like, the Oscar winner of whatever, but in French. And so it's, there's all this stupid pomp and circumstance, but it, like, kind of adds to it, because when they walk in the theater, everyone stands up and they're filming them, kind of like when Jimmy Kimmel walks in during the Oscars to that theater next door and you get the live reaction. Like, that's what you're seeing as you're sitting in the audience at a Cannes movie premiere. It's really weird, but I was definitely, like, my mind was blown. I was like, whoa.
And there's something that is both really unbelievably privileged about the whole experience and yet weirdly egalitarian at the same time. I mean, Thierry Frémaux, in this press conference that he gave at the start of the festival.
He's the festival director.
He's the artistic director, delegate general of the festival. And he gave this press conference in part, I think, to sort of, it was like he was appearing before a firing squad. He was like, have at me, journalists, all this criticism. You know, it was really funny, actually. But he said that, you know, Cannes is the only red carpet, festival red carpet anyways, where you are going up these stairs and you are invited up these stairs. It's not just some cordoned off thing like at the Oscars where it's pretty much just celebrities and, you know, I think the journalists are, like, shuttled, you know, into the too ugly to be seen room or whatever. You know, here it's like they welcome you up this carpet and you are invited to partake. And so he was kind of doing this to justify why no selfies, because it's like, you come, we invite everyone in who has a ticket.
He does. He stands at the top of the carpet, sort of like he shakes everyone's hand. I observed he loves to be in a photograph, loves a good press op, and they don't have interviews on the red carpet like they do here, so it's just photographs. So everyone's just voguing, and then they walk in.
Now, tell me about some of the movies, I think, for an American audience. Maybe first of all, how many movies did you each see?
This is going to be fun.
At the festival? Justin?
35.
Amy?
5.
But so, and the number of parties, I went to like 0, and Amy probably went
35. Well, let's preface this by saying, so Justin has gone to Cannes forever, and our other film critic, Kenneth Tran, also goes, and they have their routine down. They see all of the in-competition films, and Kenny interviews a lot of the big filmmakers from that. So I was like, well, what's left for me over here? Like, what should I do? You know, I can't write the same things they're writing. And so I thought, you know, maybe I'll dive into the lifestyle and scene a little bit. And so Justin and I led completely different lives. We shared an Airbnb, but I was a creature of the night and he was a...
Yes.
I don't know.
But we came back together and debriefed, you know, every night, which was fun. But yeah, I know, as Amy says, and I kind of keep this daily kind of critical diary of most of the movies I've seen, mostly in the competition, because that is what people are following most closely and really care about. I didn't see as many movies outside the competition as I would have liked, but I did try to do that as well. But the competition was quite good, I thought.
And now, I think for American audiences, you know, the movie that I think maybe people are most interested in is Spike Lee's BlacKkKlansman. Amy, your coverage of that press conference, I mean, one thing I like about the Cannes Film Festival, someone who's never been there, is they post all their press conferences online, and so you can watch that press conference, and it seems incredibly dramatic when Spike Lee is talking at the beginning of that press conference. What did it feel like in the room? Was it different from, say, like at other film festivals?
Well, also, like, that was another thing I didn't understand about Cannes, was this whole press conference thing. Like, Justin was saying, you know, oh, well, after the movie premieres, you go to the press conference. And here it's like, I'm skipping the press conference. That's available to anyone. Like, why would I do that? But I think it's sort of a mixture of, like, foreign journalists asked really outlandish questions, which can be interesting. And this is also the first united front the filmmaking team has, like, to the world. And for, in Spike Lee's case, he clearly had a message he wanted to convey. And so he came out, you know, like, guns blazing, clearly had planned what he wanted to say about the Trump administration and how his film fit into commentary about that. And he just, like, went off. He was swearing, which really was hard for me as an LA Times journalist, that it got so muted in the paper, but they wouldn't let mother expletive in. So it was just ellipses.
It's worth noting, too. So I was at the press conference after the awards ceremony where Black Klansman won the Grand Prix, which is the second prize, basically, you know, a big award for that movie. And one that I imagine the programmers were kind of a little grateful for, because a lot of times in the past, you know, movies like Mystic River and LA Confidential and No Country for Old Men, you know, go on to, like, Oscar glory. And that is sort of seen as their, okay, and the juries change every year, but they tend to overlook the big quality, critically acclaimed American movies like that. So I think it was here, and I'm not saying that this had any bearing on the jury's decision, but I just can't help but feel the festival was happy about that, because it's sort of an enticement for more American movies to say, hey, you could win a big award, you could really put your film on the map, and the fall festival season is going to get really crowded and competitive. Maybe some of you should come to Cannes in the summer. I was there at that press conference, and they actually brought Spike Lee back afterward, after the jury had cleared out, and he said, and I typed this up, he said, like, I want to do a rewind of my previous profane press conference. So without any expletives, he actually kind of, you know, said some of the same things.
Oh, because he wanted the message to get out there. That wasn't beeped.
I think, yeah, it was a chance. I don't usually stay for this, but I imagine that sometimes they bring back a lot of the big winners to, like, make extra, you know, comments. It's kind of like backstage at the Oscars, right? You know, yeah. He said he hoped that the film would help us to, I quote, start to get back to the truth, goodness, love, and not hate, end quote. So it is a very angry film, and I think what makes it powerful.
But it's also funny.
It's very funny, too. It's a mixture of things, and it's kind of what Spike Lee can do so well, is he channels his rage into humor and vice versa. So there's this real exuberance to this movie, which does build to this very, you know, not mincing words, excoriation of white supremacy in Donald Trump's America. So it doesn't hold back, and I think that's partly why people liked it a lot.
And led me to send an email to David Duke as part of my reporting. I was like, yes, yeah. Okay, when will this happen again? Like, mm-hmm. During Cannes, do you write, like, Dear Mr. Duke, hope this finds you well? That's my usual intro, but, like,
Dear Grand Wizard.
Right, how do you start that email?
Did you get an email back?
Not yet.
And Justin, one thing I want to be sure to ask you, we've spoken here on the podcast before about how the response to movies from festivals can sometimes be difficult to parse as a movie then sort of rolls out into the world. And in particular, with this sort of international press corps that was presented with Black Klansman, it was widely noted, at least in my Twitter feed, that there were not a lot of Black journalists among mm-hmm. the journalists at Cannes. Do you think that the way the film was received now and at Cannes, do you expect some adjustment or change in that as the movie rolls out? Or do you think that the sort of the critical consensus is going to be the critical consensus?
I really wish there were more Black journalists at Cannes. I mean, it's a hugely important thing. It does feel as though the critical conversation on the film certainly has only just begun, and that a vital part of it is missing and will be hopefully filled in as the film rolls out in August, and I'm sure it will be. I feel like the critical reaction overall to Black Klansman was just what it should have been. I don't think that there was this through the roof, unrealistic, this is our next Best Picture winner, nothing like that. I did sense that it was more popular with American critics than with European ones. And there's, you know, if you watch the film, I don't think it's unrealistic to see why that might be the case. I did talk to several kind of European colleagues of mine who found it really just exaggerated and unsubtle and, you know, unsatisfying as a result. Whereas I think the American response was, you know, again, not like rapturous, but really positive, and said, this is a really good, entertaining movie. Spike Lee's back. This is terrific, you know, and it's great that it's here. It'd be funny to think if there were more American films, if this were a year where they had, like, you know, Sacred Deer and The Beguiled, or, you know, Meyerowitz Stories, a whole bunch like that. I still think this film would have stood out, but would it have won a big award? Who can say? Yeah.
Also, though, I mean, and Spike said as much in one of the many conferences or interviews he did, that, like, this is about also discrimination towards Jewish people and Black people.
Very true.
And the Ku Klux Klan hates a lot of different ethnicities and races. And
Adam Driver plays the Jewish cop who is Ron Stallworth, the Black cop, their partners. So it's about how a Black cop and a Jewish cop together infiltrate, partially take down part of the Ku Klux Klan.
And now it seems like from the coverage that I was seeing of the festival that this, it felt more politicized, not so much in the films themselves, but in the atmosphere, people talking a lot about the jury. There were a number of events during the festival that, you know, had to do specifically with gender parity among filmmakers. What was that like on the ground, Amy? Did it feel to you in relation to other festivals that you've been to that there was this more sort of electrified, politicized air to the festival?
Well, I mean, I remember at Sundance this year, for example, obviously we had March commemorating a year since the inauguration. And that felt like it really fit in with me in a year where there were docs about Jane Fonda and Gloria Allred and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And there were political, very current movies. But I agree that at Cannes, it was like, especially when the festival director had said only a few months ago, like, we're not doing any Me Too events. Like, that's not our MO. We don't plan these sort of fake events. They not fake, but, you know, pre-planned things. They need to come up naturally. And then, you know, he signs on with a last-minute effort for 82 women to walk up the red carpet stairs as a representation of the 82 female filmmakers who have directed movies in Cannes inception.
In the competition.
In the competition, yeah. Right. And then he also signed a treaty pledging to be more transparent about how Cannes selects the movies in its competition and also, like, people who are on its staff. So while these are all great things, and I think especially the 82 women marching up the carpet was far more profound than, you know, you'd be led to believe. It seems sort of like stunty. But then Cate Blanchett and Agnes Varda are up there like saying how important it is to have gender parity in the industry and all these pictures of these women arm in arm walking up. I thought it was like really moving. And yet it didn't feel like it was a part of Cannes necessarily. Yeah. What do you think, Justin?
I think it's hard to do that. I give the festival props for making these efforts. And I think it does take a great effort on their part because France, Cannes, which is a stand-in for France, which is so mired in tradition and so reluctant, I think, to change. I think it takes a lot out of them to just get their head in the game sort of
poor
and actually
babies.
Do these things. No, I know. I'm not not making apologies
so
for
them.
So much
out of them.
It does. I mean, it's just like you go there and it's like it's part of the reason why the festival is so entrenched in ways that make it hard to navigate, even just on a really basic level. Like, there's just technical things that they do that really have nothing to do with gender politics or anything. It's just, it can be a frustrating place. You feel like, okay, this is a festival that prides itself on this tradition. So it's very good that they're taking these steps. That 82 women march took place before the premiere of the film Girls of the Sun, which is directed by a French woman, Eva Husson, and is about female soldiers in, you know, Iraqi Kurdistan. And, you know, fighting back is based on true story, of course. So all of that was very heavily symbolic. The movie itself was not very good at all. In fact, I think was generally considered to be the worst film in the competition. So that was one of three films directed by women. The other two were much better received and both won major prizes, in fact. But it was an example of how, you know, sometimes there should have been, I wish there had been more films directed by women in the competition. And I
and
think,
then, like, Terry, the director, had made an odd remark about how, like, when you have a film in competition here, you're on a global stage and, like, you really need to be ready for that, kind of implying that female filmmakers weren't. I mean, there were just a lot of comments throughout that
faux pas,
you know,
yeah.
Right. Like, you'd have these amazing marches and these treaties being signed. And then there were, like, Terry Gilliam, who said that Me Too is mob rule, and he thinks a lot of women benefited off of their relationships with Harvey, is like celebrated in the competition. And then John Travolta, in a festival conversation, says he doesn't honestly know a lot about Me Too because he just tries to treat everyone equally. It's like there were a lot of tone-deaf remarks being made.
Which is why it was so great when Asia Argento got on stage at the closing ceremony. And I just love how, I mean, it was jarring as hell, and I just love that she just, you know,
what she said.
Without preamble, she said, I think I've committed the first few lines of her speech to memory. She said, you know, in 1997, I was raped by Harvey Weinstein here at Cannes. I was 21 years old. This festival was his hunting ground. I will make a prediction, you know, she said she would predict that he would never be welcome back here again. And then she called out the unnamed people in the room who were, you know, guilty of complicit and who had mistreated women themselves and said, you know who you are. And more importantly, we know who you are and we're not going to let you get away with it any longer. So it was extremely powerful. And I like the way that the festival, I do think in ways that were sometimes clumsy but indelible none the same, it built to that moment through these staged but powerful events along the way.
And what was the response to Asya's comment? Like, what was the feeling when she said that?
I was watching in the side room that journalists sit in the theater, and we were watching a live transmission, so I wasn't in the room to be able to gauge, but it seemed a little bit muted. It felt like if she had been speaking, I think, on an American stage or platform, the applause would have started much sooner, but they kind of waited, and then there was a burst of applause.
Did you see someone tweet, like, that the only person who came up to her after
she,
the... Yeah.
She tweeted that herself.
Oh, she did.
Argento did it, said, like, Spike Lee was the only person who came up to me and thanked me or said anything nice to me about that. So, yeah. Yeah, I do think, you know, it was... And they did. They presented this, you know, right before giving the Best Actress Award, so, you know... Yeah.
I mean, Asya Argento alleges that she was raped by Harvey at... the Hotel du Cap, which is like a huge staple of the party scene in Cannes. And I was like simultaneously super excited to see it because it's beautiful and on the ocean and like known for being luxurious, and also terrified because there's like all these haunting memories that happened there. And they had the Amphor gala the last night there. And you couldn't help, like, I personally couldn't help but think, wow, all these gnarly things went down and all these people are just wearing, you know, diamonds and drinking champagne and acting like it never happened.
And now it is part of the mystique of the festival and its appeal that there's always this kind of sex appeal, this glamour to it of, you know, women in beautiful dresses and men all in tuxedos. And do you feel that that was muted at all? Or what did, do you think that this being the first sort of post-Harvey, post-Me Too year of the festival, did it change that at all?
I mean, clearly I haven't been before, but I definitely made it my mission, as we said earlier, to go to a lot of these parties to see, because everyone was saying, oh, there's no parties this year. There's no celebrities this year. What I saw at the parties was insane, like completely over the top, so ridiculous, very glamorous. I mean, I don't, you know, as a journalist in the U.S., like when you go to the Oscars, they say wear a black tie. You kind of like wear something nice, but not that. Like, I did not have anything nearly fancy enough for these. Like, these people were wearing full designer ball gowns. Like, and to describe the environment, like, the hotels are along this road of all designer, like Dolce & Gabbana, Fendi, Gucci, and they put all of their, like, runway dresses in the, it's not like even at Rodeo Drive where they just have purses. It's like, who would buy an off-the-runway dress? Someone who's walking to a premiere tonight. Like, you know, like, this is the actual environment there. So, no, I didn't witness any dissolution of glamour. And in fact, I went to a party, as I wrote about, for a $900 ice cream cooler, leather ice cream cooler that was designed for Magnum Ice Cream by Alexander Wang, as a fashion designer. So if you think that Cannes' ridiculousness quotient has gone down, like, no, come on.
Please speak more about the ice cream cooler party, which your report on is one of my favorite pieces of writing, and I don't remember how long. I mean, the sustained level of ridiculousness and your exacting reportage thereof.
Thank
was
you so much,
amazing.
Mark. I know I'm destined for a Pulitzer on this one. Basically, I waited 2 hours to get into a party where you were celebrating this $900 ice cream cooler, which I don't think has a cooling agent, by the way. Like, so it could fit 6 ice cream bars, maybe, but, like, if you were putting in ice, what, 2? Like, I just feel it's impractical. And inside, Bella Hadid, who is a model, was there with The Weeknd, a singer who, apparently Timothée Chalamet and The Weeknd were all about, around Cannes. That they were the buddy duo. And, like, it was just, you know, they had this crazy ice. I'm not doing a good job. It's, like, on the beach. There's all these hot people. You're just, like, this fancy big party in honor of the ice cream cooler. Like, what? It doesn't make sense. It just,
but you waited in a line to get in, and then you waited in another line to get
an ice cream bar, which was, like, custom and really good. And they put gold flakes on it. And that was the best part. But I waited 45 minutes for that. Everywhere I went, I didn't like this about Cannes. They don't care about journalists. Like, you will get invited to things and then they treat you like crap. Like, you show up, everything I went to, I waited at least an hour. And I had an invitation in hand and I'd go and I'd be like, hi, I'm this. And I'd be like, cool, go in this crappy penned area where it's freezing outside and wait. Like, they just don't care about you.
And now, Justin, that's one of the things with regards to Cannes. I myself have never been. I'm going to be honest here. I'm sort of terrified to ever try to go because I've heard all these legends of the pass system that they, unlike many other festivals, have a very specific, very tiered system of passes and badges for getting into things. Can you kind of explain that a little bit? And is it something to be afraid of?
not for Justin Chang, white level badge holder.
Yeah, the white badge. Talk about white supremacy, right? The white badge is the highest. No, it's terrible. It's this color-coded system, and then it goes rose pasty, which is pink with a yellow dot on it.
That's me.
That's Amy. So don't worry, Mark. You know, the LA Times does benefit then from
rose,
excellent.
Then blue.
Yeah, access. So yeah, then rose, and then blue, and then yellow being the worst. So in which case you have to line up for like an hour or two in advance. And even then it's not guaranteed that you'll get into a screening. Whereas if you have a white or a rose pasty, you can swan your way into the Palais de Festival.
You guys should have seen Justin swanning. He was swanning.
I've had 13 years.
I have to go in the white lane. Goodbye.
No, and it's true. I mean, it's this very sort of not democratic, very elitist kind of system, and has, again, like everything in Cannes, been around forever. So,
but can you explain to me how that would be different from, say, Sundance, where we get a Press Express badge?
Press Express, exactly. It's the same, only I guess there's only two layers. You're either Press Express or you're General Press. So but it's not quite so like coded with these layers. Like, yes, you're the best, and no, here you're total crap. So it's crueler. For sure. But I think that there was a sense it maybe felt like because attendance was perhaps, I don't have the numbers to support this, but from hearing that attendance might have been slightly down or something, I didn't have any trouble getting into screenings this time. Sometimes I get shut out and if I'm too late or something, or if I'm just trying to dash from one thing to another. But that didn't happen this year.
Tell me a little bit more just about some of the movies, and you tell me if I'm wrong. It is possible that we did just see at least five movies that could easily make up the nominees for the foreign language Oscar next year. I mean, just by my own count, I think Cold War, Burning, Shoplifters, I'm going to mispronounce this.
Capernaum,
and also Happy as Lazaro. I mean, does that sound right to you? And does that feel about on target for a typical Cannes as far as like movies from different countries with their respective auteurs that could probably be in the mix for the foreign language Oscar?
Yeah, Cannes does very well, I think, generally at the foreign language film Oscar choices, you know, things like Amour and The Great Beauty, you know, both winners, both of which premiered in competition at Cannes. So very possibly, I mean, it would wait to be see if those films get selected by their countries. You would think they would, but not necessarily. I know for a fact that Capernaum, which is from the Lebanese director Nadine Labaki, was widely tipped to win the Palme d'Or, and people thought, you know, and I kind of disliked the somewhat cynical assumption that because it was directed by a woman and had a very, you know, strong emotional impact on most of those who saw it, that it was kind of a shoe-in, you know, and it didn't happen in the end. The movie won the jury prize, which is basically third place. But that movie was bought by Sony Classics before it even premiered. The sales buzz was just off the roof. There were bidding wars. So I think that is absolutely being eyed for an Oscar campaign, and a lot of people were already saying that they expected to win. So, but it didn't win the Palme. That went to Shoplifters, which was a film from the Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda, who is, it's a wonderful film. It's one of his very best. It wasn't my first choice for the Palme. That would have been Burning by Lee Chang-dong, the South Korean director, but Shoplifters was my second favorite, so I really couldn't complain. And Koreeda is someone who has been at Cannes. Like, this was his fifth film in competition. His movies are so consistently excellent. And I think he's become very easy to take for granted. So I was really pleased that, especially in a year that was so heavily politicized for so many different reasons, that they kind of saw through all that and saw this lovely, quiet, graceful family drama and gave it to him, you know. And it's like when you win the Palme d'Or, it's like you always want like your favorite filmmakers, you know. It's like, you know, you should have, you know, I think like Wong Kar-wai should have a Palme d'Or, and you know, why doesn't he? And so, you know, or like, you know, think about some other filmmaker. And so many, I think, art house film fans are glad that Koreeda now has a Palme, you know, for, you know, and it almost doesn't matter which movie he won it for.
And now it seems like the jury this year, I mean, it was made up. It had Cate Blanchett, Ava DuVernay, Kristen Stewart, Lea Seydoux, Andrzej Ignatieff.
Can I just say, I did not realize just the sartorial effort that went into being a jury member at Cannes. Like, it's different than any other festival. You have to go to every single red carpet premiere. And for a Kristen Stewart or Cate Blanchett, that means they're getting fully glammed. They also have, like, photo calls and other events to go to. Like, you're bringing, so 2 weeks worth of dresses plus 2 days, two outfits a day, I would say. I ran into my girl Kay Stu at a party, and I was like, this just seems like a very intense effort, like, to look good all the time. And there was even a story about she took off her high heels at some point on the red carpet, and if you know Kay Stu, like, that's kind of just her vibe. And everyone was like, oh, it's a statement about her. She's rebelling against the high heel rule. And I wrote her publicist, and she was like, really? Like, no. it's just her being over it.
She did the same thing.
Take off her heels.
She'd done that before, I think, at Cannes.
But yeah, it was interesting. Like, all the star power really was on the jury, I would say.
It was indeed. And it was interesting that, to a degree more than I think I ever remember with any jury, the women dominated, not just in numbers. There were 5 women, 4 men. But you noticed, Amy, they were like always like linked arm in arm.
Yeah, like
always,
Denis Villeneuve, who's a very well-known filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear anything from him.
Barely saw him, I think, except for, you know, at the end, you know, during sort of the press conference and everything. But for the most part, it's just those women. And it was really, really deliberate. And they looked stunning. But it was about more than that. There was this incredible show of solidarity. And the men kind of fell back behind them most of the time.
Tell me a little bit just your impression, Justin, of the awards. As you said, the fact that going into the festival, there was this sort of assumption that they would give top prizes to the female filmmakers. And maybe from the press conference that you saw after the awards and their responses to that, it seems like they masterfully addressed those things, worked around those things. I don't think anyone would say that the awards were some act of tokenism or overly politicized. And so what were your impressions of how this group of people grappled with that group of films?
I think masterful is absolutely the word. Cate Blanchett should be president every year. I really do think that. She, at the end, there were questions. And these press conferences, I've sat through almost all of them in the time I've been there. And they're often very awkward affairs where nobody wants to say anything. And the jury president is not necessarily the best master of ceremonies. Cate Blanchett, of course, she tried to get other jurors to speak. And Kristen Stewart was like having none of it. She just kind of didn't want to say anything, which is totally fine. But, you know, there were stupid questions. There were rude or just offbeat based questions. And Cate Blanchett just received every single one of them with just elan, eloquence, wit.
I'm sorry, she received it with what now?
Elan. You know, oh. Sorry, just really like she made everyone feel at ease, and she just navigated every question, you know, beautifully, and including questions directed at, you know, the sort of methodology or the rationale behind some of their choices and political considerations. And she was enormously complimentary to the selection and to all the films. And, you know, as people ask things like, why wasn't this film recognized? And she's like, you know, and she said, you know, just because we don't give something an award doesn't mean we disregard it, you know, and she's kind of so extremely diplomatic. I've never seen anyone play that role as magnificently as she did. The awards themselves, I thought, again, I was disappointed that Burning, which I think is a masterpiece and was to me by far the best film in the competition, it got an average of 3.8 out of 4 on the Screen International jury grid that they do every year, which is an all-time record. No other film came even close to that. I think it beat the record set by Tony Erdman a few years ago. Stunning, stunning film, but also, you know, in some ways a difficult film that I could understand a jury maybe not being able to get the consensus on. And a film like Shoplifters, which was also wonderful and deserving, had an easier time of getting that kind of consensus. But all the other things, they spread the wealth around. They gave a special Palme d'Or to Jean-Luc Godard because, you know, you have to acknowledge Godard. And it would have been amazing if they'd like given him the Palme outright, but they gave him to recognize just how cutting edge he still is and just the weight of his legacy. Again, toward the end, it felt really like Nadine Labaki, Capernaum had that momentum on its side. It played near the very end of the festival, got a huge emotional response.
Except from you.
Yeah. I was about to say, Amy just outed me. Yeah. No, I, the movie got to me. I think it's really strong.
I heard the same thing. I heard this movie so emotional.
It's very emotional. And it's about, you know, this boy who's like born into poverty and ends up suing his parents because for bringing him into this cruel world in the Beirut slums and winds up taking care of this child. Another, you know, it's almost like orphan raising orphan. It's heartrending sometimes. I mean, it's, you know, and you could say like putting, you know, suffering children on camera and there's nothing easier than to do than make you cry. But she does have a lot of skill with the way she puts it together. I do think the movie is kind of clumsy and manipulative in ways that made me grateful that it didn't win the Palme because I don't think it was remotely the best film, although it was definitely affecting. And I think that Nadine Labaki has totally taken leaps and bounds as a filmmaker. But again, look, the movie could have won the Palme, and there might have been charges of tokenism, but I think a lot of people would have said, no, this was their favorite film in the festival, and that is totally justifiable. Certainly would have been a much better choice than, say, I, Daniel Blake 2 years ago, whatever. So, but I love that they, you know, that one, and then Happy as Lazaro, directed by a female Italian director, Alice Rohrwacher, which I think is a much better film, actually. And so, and that one was a lot of other people's favorite. But I really like how deftly they did it. They gave these two films awards, both of which were deserving of awards. But they said in the end that we're supporting these female filmmakers, but they didn't direct our favorite film in the selection. And believe, you know, and I think if they had directed their favorite film, they would have absolutely given it to that, but they gave it to Corrieta instead. So I think there was this very smart and very deft balance of those political considerations with ultimately the artistic merits of what they thought was the best movie.
Guys, I just realized I actually saw 7 films.
Good for you.
Yeah, thank you. You think less of me? I think a little bit more
of me
now, Justin?
Yes. I have always thought highly
of
you.
Oh, yeah, okay. You should have seen the scorn in this man's eyes when I returned from each night of observing the partying.
There was no scorn, just like, Amy, you're not seeing movies. You're depriving yourself.
I would have preferred to do that, trust me. You think I want to wait outside a freaking ice cream cooler for 2 hours?
An atmosphere that is basically like a giant ice cream cooler at night, anyway.
I think we're going to wrap our talk. Although, Amy, can you help me with one thing? Do you know now how to say in French, but I'm on the list?
I should, because that is all I heard the entire time was just French men. By the way, very elbow-heavy culture there. You know, like no risk, just pushing and shoving you out of the way. Like, watch out if you are a shorty McShorty like me. But yeah, just French men in tuxedos muttering at the sky. But I'm on the list. Got you nowhere.
And with that, we're going to wrap up our talk today. Please tell the folks where to find your work online there, Amy.
You can find me at Amy K in LA on Twitter.
And Justin?
I am at Justin C. Chang.
And for LA Times Studios and The Real, I'm Mark Olson.